Welcome once again to the chat room. Nice to have your company. This is, as I say so often, the fastest 28 minutes in television, where we grab a big topic and I get this man to talk about it for 28 minutes. Philip Jensen,
hello,
welcome.
Girl.
The topic is art.
Yeah.
And the way the arts community relates to the rest of the community. I presume what the artists are about is wanting to create or recreate something beautiful.
I guess that's fundamental at the heart of it, although sometimes it may not be beautiful, it may be harsh that they want to create. That sometimes it's to hold up the horror of the world to us rather than something that's pretty beautiful, but it is to represent the world to us. Sometimes it's the challenge, sometimes it's to satirise. So there's a variety of things that would come under arts.
We'd be inclined to think of great works of art as being great works of beauty, great things of beauty, wouldn't we?
Basically, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is what is beauty something we can know for certain, or is it all subjective? You know, is it what I think is beautiful and what you think is beautiful?
The eye of the beholder.
Yeah, yeah, that's it.
No, I'm sure that it is objective because of God. That is, God has created the world as a beautiful place. He created the trees to be seen in their beauty in the Garden of Eden. And he's created us with minds that perceive his world in a certain framework. So, and there are little evidences of it. Surveys have shown that around the world, people have an idea of the facial beauty as being symmetrical, which is why you and I are so good looking, of course.
Yes. So you put the mirror down the middle and it's exactly the
yes.
same balance.
And so the person yes. whose face is symmetrical, I've forgotten which of the American actors particularly has it, but they are seen as beautiful in all cultures everywhere.
Right.
It's a human perception. And likewise, connected to that is the Greek discovery of mathematical relationships in columns and the like, which have a certain inherent beauty for people without reference to their culture, their upbringing, their background. So, you know, and the old nurture-nature debates are always a problem for us, but built into us is a sense of what is beautiful.
So when we come around the corner in the bushwalk and we see a distant view and say, that's beautiful, we're probably, apart from anything else, seeing some mathematical proportions which are exactly right.
Yep, that's right, and which we would all see as beautiful, and some contrastings of colours and the like, which most people coming around that corner would say, wow, that's fantastic.
And that kind of thing stimulates artists and they want to create it. I remember a writer saying once, one of the ways you can tell that human beings are made in the image of God is by saying, well, what is God? Well, whatever he is, he's a creator.
Yes.
So human beings have this urge to be creative.
Yes, although there's a fundamental difference in our creation, of course. That is, God creates out of nothing, whereas we shape what is already there.
We recreate.
Now, he does that. In Genesis 1, the first couple of verses, he creates everything.
Yes.
So it's all chaos and without form or void. And the rest of Genesis 1 is a manufacturing, is a reshaping of it all, or shaping it for the first time. Tolkien said that he didn't like being called a creative writer, because there's only one creator, that's God. Because only God can bring it out of nothing.
In fact, he coined the expression, I think, sub-creation.
Yeah, that's a good way of saying it, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we can do that. And we have that urge to us. It does mark us out from the animals. I mean, there's lots of things about us that are different to other animals. But creating things for beauty is very human.
Is there a danger in it? I mean, I'm thinking about the Second Commandment, you know, graven images, that kind of thing. The idea that there can be a risk in us creating or sub-creating images which then become powerful or significant or important to us.
I mean, the arts are more than visual images. But take the visual images one. I mean, Shakespeare's part of the arts.
And music is part of the arts,
But taking the visual one, yes, God warns us against idolatry for a variety of reasons. One is the visual is very powerful. It's the most powerful sense that we have. In fact, it dominates our other senses. The deaf person hears better because they don't have our sight. Because we have sight, we don't develop our capacity for hearing.
Swamps the rest.
It swamps the rest.
Yes.
And so it's a very powerful medium is our sight. Secondly, when you try and present God visually, you always misrepresent God. Because God is powerful, artworks are not. God is speaking, artworks are dumb. God is moves, artworks stay still unless we move them. God, that is the fundamental things about God. God is personal, artworks are impersonal. God is a subject, artwork is always object. All the fundamental things about God, art can't do. Now, I don't know what you say about holographs, they can do all kinds of things, but
yes.
Art can't do what is God. And so they don't represent God, they misrepresent God. On the other hand, if you have picture books of the Bible and you don't have Jesus there as a human being, then you're misrepresenting Jesus because you're saying he's not part of the historical world. And so you have what is called a docetic Jesus, that Jesus wasn't fully human or really human, he just appeared to be. And to take it on the third hand, on the other hand, when you have Jesus presented in the picture books, people think that that's what he actually looked like, especially yes. in children's books. You yes. think, oh, I know what Jesus looked like. And
blonde and blue-eyed and things
blonde
like that.
Blonde and blue-eyed, yes. as every Jewish boy was in those days. One of the characteristics of the Bible is that Jesus' appearance is never described. And indeed, Isaiah chapter 52 warns us that there was nothing about him physically that was attractive. And so it misrepresents Jesus when we present him physically. On the other hand, not to present him misrepresents him. But always to represent God physically is always wrong.
It's a bit of a dilemma representing Jesus. That there used to be a law in Britain that filmmakers, movie makers, could not depict on the screen either Jesus or the reigning monarch.
I hope they could pick the difference between the two.
And the result was they made some, I've seen some of the British films made back in those black and white days in which you saw the back of Jesus' head.
Yes, saw the shadow pass by. Yes.
But you didn't see his face. But it's wrestling with that problem of yes. he's a real person, but yes. we don't know what he looked like.
Yes.
And there isn't a solution to that problem.
There isn't a solution to that problem. But it's a problem of the children's Bibles, kind of. It's a children's educational problem, I think. Once you move into church and church buildings, then I think it's very dangerous to have representations of Jesus, and it's even worse to have representations of the divine.
Well, that's presumably what the Ten Commandments are telling us. That's why we don't have graven images. We don't have idols right. in that sense. But there's still a place for us as human beings to be sub-creators and to make beautiful images, which are powerful.
Yes.
And because they're powerful, they have an impact on people.
Yes.
So what responsibility does the artist have? Is the artist just there to make the most stunning, powerful poem or work of art or music or whatever? Or is the artist also responsible to think, how will this affect people? How will they respond?
Well, there's a lot spoken today about it being self-expression, the artist expressing themselves. I think from a Christian perspective, that's a great failure, really. The artist who is Christian would be looking to not express himself, but to enjoy God's creation, however he may do that. But even leaving that aside for a moment, the art that is self-expression needs never be shown to anybody. But as soon as you have an exhibition,
yes, yes,
you are communicating. You're not just expressing. You're not just doing what you want to do. You're communicating to others. I mean, what we're doing at the moment is a visual art.
Yes, in a sense. At a modest level.
A very modest, you know. but it's visual art.
Yes.
And it's trying to communicate. Now, great paintings communicate. And really great ones can communicate very powerfully. I remember seeing a Picasso of a woman he hated, in which it was presented in that cubist form. And as you stood watching for a while, or as I stood watching, I could feel that he hated this woman.
Yes.
It was, you know, I didn't like the piece of art myself, but I could personally feel the power.
And he was communicating that to you.
How he did it, I do not know.
I remember a winner of the Archibald Prize talking about his portrait and saying he wanted people who saw the portrait to be told what was going on inside this person.
Yes.
So he saw it as something speaking yes. to the viewers.
And great portraiture, which, I mean, of all the visual arts is the one I enjoy the most, it seems to me, conveys that you're looking at a person, yes. not an object. Yes. Now, I'm never sure how they do it, but
No, the mind is ticking over inside the picture in some way.
Somehow. Yes, you clever. Can see that the person is the person. Now, it's the holding of the head, the glint in the eye, the whatever it is. How they do it, that's why they're artists, that's why I'm not.
Yeah. But
that ability to communicate more than just a visual set of patches, it's very clever and very powerful.
Because it is communication, because it's speaking to the people who read or see or hear the work of art, come back to this question of responsibility to the community. What does the artist have to think about the recipients?
Well, all teachers should know that the important thing is not the message that's sent, but the message that's received.
Right.
And you tailor, I mean, I presume you do it in journalism, you tailor the message you're communicating in terms of the recipient. Now, you can never do it perfectly because you're not the recipient. But getting to know what recipients are about, what makes people tick, how people hear, is part of good communication. And I think it's a little false to say, well, look, I'm just giving you my stuff, and if you pick it up, good for you, and if you don't pick it up, more fool you. Because now that's the case, I might as well just do it in a phone box to myself. You know, I mean, it's
like teenagers who write poetry in their diaries that don't want anyone to ever read. That's, well, that's not good communication.
No, that's good self-expression, and I'm glad for them. And please don't show it to me.
But but that's not what the artist is doing. The artist is communicating, and they have to think about it. So does that mean the community has got something to say back to the artist? We're getting a message you may not have intended to send, and we're not happy with the message that's coming across?
They're very often inviting us to look at the world the way they look at the world.
Right.
That's what a clever comedian is doing. He's saying, have you noticed how funny this world is? Look here, how funny I am, how quirky I am, look here.
Yes.
Because I'm trying to say, you're like that too, aren't you? And you share with me in the kind of absurdity, in the oddities, in the weirdness. Now, art, in a sense, is inviting you in to see the world as the artist sees it. That can be for sheer aesthetic joy, isn't it? Magnificent. Or it can be, aren't we doing a dreadful thing here? You know, I mean, the photo of the little girl naked running down with napalm in Vietnam, right? That photo was a powerful piece of art which said, look at the world, it's wrong.
Now that shocks us,
yes,
but it tells us something about the world that we...
Very powerful art.
Yes.
All the people are being killed does nothing compared to seeing on your television show.
Which is your point about how strong the visual is.
Very powerful, yes. Likewise, the unforgettable image of that man standing in front of the tank in Tiananmen Square.
Yeah, carrying his shopping bags.
Yes. That was just an incredible piece of art.
Although it wasn't created as such. That was accidental art.
Yes, accidental art in a sense, although the photographer knew what he was watching. But if
the world that the artist is inviting us into is a world that the community says, we find this disturbing or we're afraid it will do bad things in our community, we don't want you to say that to us.
Well, you know, that's tricky, isn't it?
It is.
The community needs messages sent to them.
Yes.
Sassoon's poetry on the First World War. I wasn't living, of course, in those days, just want to hasten to add.
Your children think you were.
Yes, certainly. But deep effect upon the attitude to war that you can gain from reading that kind of poetry. It's moving and makes you ask hard questions, and it's important that it is read.
Yes.
Even though it's uncomfortable, unpleasant, challenging, you get a whole series of this is really bad news, but it's important it is read.
Right.
You can see why a government would want to say you mustn't have Sassoon's poetry because you won't go out and fight out the trenches if you have it.
Yes.
So if you give to governments the power to stop the Sassoons...
So that's the problem of art and censorship, isn't it?
Yeah,
so,
it's a real problem.
And what you're saying is censorship is dangerous and we need to be very wary of censorship.
Yeah. Because there is, to run back to your other question, there is things that are just offensive. There are things that are gratuitously offensive. I saw something the other day on television where they were making fun of the Pope. Now, I find the Pope's claims to be wrong and, to some extent, blasphemous, really, because he claims to do the work that the Holy Spirit it does. But, and I don't mind that a person like the reformers and that generation had cartoons depicting the Pope in his error out of serious comment that could confront people.
There was an important idea behind it.
An important idea. But just cheap shots of making fun of the Pope, I think, well, it was a lack of imagination. You know, my father used to always tell me that when the joke has to be about the toilet, you know the person's not funny. Because anybody can make anything about toilets funny, because we're all a bit uptight about toilets one way or another, so it's easy to make it funny. But that means you're not much of a comedian if you've got to go to the toilet jokes. Well, a joke about the Pope for no good purpose is just offensive to the Catholic community.
Gratuitously offensive.
It's gratuitously offensive. And I don't think that it's a very appropriate thing to be on our very limited TV free-to-air channels. I mean, we're all paying for these. A quarter of the population is paying to be gratuitously offended.
Gratuitously offended, but you wouldn't want a law that censored it because of the risks that would bring in.
That's right, because the Pope is wrong and it needs to be said. There needs to be a vehicle where people can say, with all due respect, you're wrong.
Yes.
There are men who are very great men who have become popes. I think the last pope was a man of enormous courage and very impressive man, even in his death, especially in his death. But I think the role he occupied was a wrong. I think he was in error. Now, I should be able to say that somewhere and not have the government censor me.
Yes, yes.
On the other hand, the more people just are gratuitous or vilifying,
yes,
not having it as a reasonable discussion, it's the problem with the cartoons about Muhammad that the Danish put out. Now, I saw this morning that there were some bombs outside the Danish embassy in Pakistan. There is an attempt at censorship. You're not allowed to make the point about Muhammad. Well, maybe cartoons are the wrong vehicle to make the point, but someone somewhere needs to say that the kind of glamorisation of the life of Muhammad is not right.
So when we try to work out what the balance is between art and censorship, and I mean, we do have some censorship in our society. We've got to be honest about it. There is censorship.
Lots of censorship.
That's what the law of defamation is. It's censorship.
Yes. You know,
so we live in a society which says you can't say anything. There are certain restrictions, certain limits.
Right. And then the censorship about people planning terrorist plots.
Yes.
Well, one man's terrorist, another man's freedom fighter, but you can understand why a government is going to crack down on people who are plotting to blow up the government.
Yes, it applies to journalists. There is an agreement, I don't think it's formal, but there's an agreement that when anyone makes a bomb hoax on an aeroplane, it won't be reported while it's happening.
Yes.
Because that tends to encourage other people to do it. Now, and that's a kind of censorship to look after the community, to care for the community.
There was a pattern to suicides, have a recurring pattern. As people hear about suicide, that increases suicides, and there was a pattern of suicides happening out at the Gap some years ago. And in the end, the government was asking journalists to stop reporting young men and women jumping off the Gap, because it was creating young men and women jumping off the Gap. And responsible communication is important because of it. And responsible communication has to do with its effect, as you were saying with the artist, that if you're going to be social, you're going to show your works, then you have to ask, well, what are the consequences of my works? Because if I am stirring up hatred, well then, as hatred happens, I've got to say, well, that's what I was doing.
Yeah. But that doesn't make the balance between... So we've got censorship. We live in a society where it says free speech is not entirely unlimited. It's reasonable for there to be limits. But it's still a difficult problem, isn't it?
Where are the limits and who does the limiting?
Yes.
See,
how much power do we want to give governments?
Yes. Or independent censors.
Yes.
Because if what they're censoring is what degenerates people, then after a while, having watched all this stuff, they presumably will be degenerated. And therefore, and on what basis do they censor? How far do you go? See, one piece of art in this context is beautiful. In that context is pornography.
Yes.
It just depends. So what you may see, some nudes in an art gallery, if it's on a public servant's computer from some website, he can get sacked.
So
it's the same picture.
So for photographer photographs, you know, 12 and 13 year olds naked, He doesn't intend pornography. That's not his intention. His intention is beauty. But his work of art may be used by other people.
Yes.
We now know that there are, that pedophiles connect with each other. Yeah. There are rings. And they, so if they say, you know, go to this gallery,
yeah,
or go to this website, you can see these pictures. Other children may be hurt and damaged because of the way what he did was, yes, used.
But in a sense, how other people abuse or misuse my material is hard for me then to be held responsible for.
Yep.
But so I think the connection is more the slow cultural change. That is, take the case that has been in the papers recently, this one that you mentioned. If this man is now penalised by court, then he becomes a martyr and he becomes very wealthy and his works become much more popular and so forth. If he is let go, then the artistic community has been told it's all right to do this. Once the artistic community thinks it's all right to do this, then it's right for the publishing houses to do that. Then it's right for the school books to do this.
There is a trickle-down effect.
There's the trickle-down effect all the time.
Mm.
Now, the defence always is, looking at this picture, have you felt degenerate? Have you felt like being a pedophile? The answer is no. Mm. Right? I've read Lady Chatterley's Lover. I actually haven't, but if you've read Lady Chatterley's Lover, how does that now make you feel? No. It's the thousands of Lady Chatterley's Lovers that get poured out over and over on us that has the effect, like the water hitting the rock. One drop.
Yep, yep.
You just can't see the effect. And it's the shifting of the values. This censorship business, they keep talking about community standards, but community standards keep being changed by the arts. So where are the community standards? Who determines what they are to start with anyway? But where are they and how can they not be affected by the arts? That's the very reason for having the censorship, to stop community standards being affected.
Yes.
And so what in our father's generation would have considered pornography, it's in the newspapers every day of the week.
Yes. If we told our parents in the grandparents in the 1950s what would be happening now, they would have said, no, that'll never happen. That's impossible.
Happen. That's right.
Yeah.
But it's happening frequently. How did it happen? Well, because
slowly.
Slowly, week in, week out, and by the massive amount of media that is out there. So the TV stations have to chew through 24 hours a day looking for material. In the end, it just keeps being pushed.
So is there a biblical way to think about this problem? Is there a biblical way in which we as Christians can think about, pray about, talk about this problem of not wanting to give governments excessive censorship powers, but not wanting the arts to take the community on a downward slope?
It's difficult, isn't it? Firstly, we've got to look after our own souls and hearts. And whereas in previous days the community had basic Christian standards, it meant that we could live comfortably not having to make decisions ourselves. That day is gone. For better and for worse, it's gone. So therefore, we now have to learn how to censor ourselves. And we need to teach our children how to do that. Because previously, our children could go into a picture show and not see things we didn't want to be seen. But now, it's not just whether it's got a rating G or M or something like that. It's what's in it. You always have to go and see things before you have your children seeing it. Whereas before, you could leave the television set on, the children could watch whatever. Yep. Now, you have to watch it with them.
That's right. They say you've got to sit with the children and watch television with them so that you become the interpreter of the values on the screen.
That's right. And teach them when to turn things off.
Yes.
And
we don't watch this kind of thing.
Yes.
And that person is behaving badly, aren't they?
Yes, that's right. And without driving our kids mad, because of there's no joy in watching anything. There's just super policemen sitting beside them all the time. The Christians get overreactive at times. Children have got a great capacity for picking fact from fantasy. In fact, they took off the what's that show where you talk about the most wanted in Australia?
Australia's Most Wanted.
Because it was too early in the evening, and children hated it because it was real life. So you can watch Mickey Mouse or whoever it is, or, you know, you can watch Donald Duck bashing up, you can watch all kinds of cartoons doing really violent things, it has no effect on a child.
Yes.
But show them a real life story.
And it's frightening.
It's terrifying.
Yeah.
And so it's now much later at night for that reason. So helping our own children, helping our own hearts and souls. One of the things is to do positive censorship, I say. That is, Philippians 4:8 says, whatsoever is beautiful, whatsoever is pure, whatsoever is excellent, think about these things. So rather than spending my time trying not to think about that, not to think about that, not to think about that, I should actually fill my mind to try and think of the things
that
are
right and good. Read a good book. Look at a good DVD.
Yes.
Right.
And so go looking for the beautiful,
yes.
Looking for the wonderful, looking for the noble, looking for the things full of virtue.
Okay.
Interesting book that Americans produced a few years ago, The Book of Virtues, which is a series of stories and poems to read to your children, which are uplifting. So rather than complaining what's there, do what's good.
And we should be encouraging each other as Christians. We should do it for ourselves, do it for our children, and encourage each other.
Yes.
Maybe we should be in our Bible study groups talking to each other about what are you watching on television, what movies are you going to, and encouraging in that sense.
That's right. And there's some American Christians have put out very good film reviews.
They're on the web. You can get them on the web.
All kinds of things. So before you actually look, you can look up and see what it's about. And I found some ones. I remember one called Helena, which was after the Second World War, a Greek community avoiding the Russians, the communists, etc. Very noble film, very uplifting film, which I wouldn't have seen in normal newspaper advertising.
Okay, so those things are available. You can find, if you do a bit of a search on the web, you'll find the Christian movie review websites. And for us to find those things is a good idea. But as Philip said, that there's no simple answer, there's no shorthand answer, there's no neat, nailed-down answer to what we do about censorship, so that we don't have too much from the governments, the arts community, so that they don't take us down the slippery slope. And because there is no neat, tidy answer, this is an important one for you to talk about with your Christian friends, with your family, with your kids, with the members of your Bible study group. This is something we can encourage each other in. So it's a good idea to keep the discussion going. Philip, thank you for your company.
It's a pleasure. It's a big subject to keep talking on.
It is, but it's worth talking about it. And we look forward to your company again next time on The Chat Room.